This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Welcome to our second class. It feels like it's been weeks since our first class. May I ask, is there anyone who didn't get a syllabus this evening? Benjamin Franklin Printer. And Benjamin Franklin, civic activist. Those are our two topics. But before we address them, as promised, a look at Max Weber, the great German sociologist of the early 20th century, whose most famous work, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, begins by invoking Benjamin Franklin. So the handout for this evening consists of some of the passages that Max Weber chose in order to present Benjamin Franklin, our man, as the embodiment of the spirit of capitalism. So let's begin with those passages and talk about Weber's thesis, the extent to which Franklin really is a good example of that thesis, and also the ways in which Franklin's life and career escape from that particular thesis. Well, here are some of those passages. Remember that time is money. He that can earn 10 shillings a day by his labor and goes abroad or sits idle, one half of that day, though he spends but sixpence during his diversion or idleness, ought not to reckon that the only expense he has really spent, or rather thrown away, 5 shillings besides. Remember that credit is money. If a man lets his money lie in my hands after it is due, he gives me the interest, or so much as I can make of it during that time. This amounts to a considerable sum, where a man has good and large credit and makes good use of it. Remember that money is of the prolific, generating nature. Money can beget money, and its offspring can beget more. And so on. 5 shillings turned is 6. Turned again, it is 7 and 3 pence. And so on, till it becomes £100. The more there is of it, the more it produces every turning, so that the profit rises quicker and quicker. He that kills a breeding sow destroys all her offspring to the 1,000th generation. He that murders a crown destroys all that it might have produced, even scores of pounds. So, this is one particular voice or one particular persona of Benjamin Franklin. Any comments on that passage or on those ways of looking at money, those metaphors?
The whole financial industry of the world is built on this premise.
Yes, the whole financial industry of the world is built on this premise, this notion that money is prolific, that money begets more money. And of course, that feeds into Franklin's emphasis on frugality. It's the perfect recipe, in other words, for the accumulation of wealth. And during his early life, for the first half, the first 42 years, Franklin was in the mode of accumulation. Starting from almost nothing, he made himself into one of the richest men in the American colonies. Perfect example of the self-made man. So his particular recipe here is undoubtedly industriousness, frugality, accumulation of wealth, or we might say of capital. Another key phrase in this passage is the first one. Remember that time is money. One of the ways of looking at early capitalism in this period, pioneered by the great English historian E.P. Thompson, no relation, unfortunately. E.P. Thompson wrote a very famous article called Time, Work Discipline, and Industrial Capitalism. And the thesis of that essay is that early capitalism the early Industrial Revolution depended very much on imposing a time discipline on workers. The clock ran the factory, and profit was to be squeezed out of workers by forcing them to work the full working day, by getting as many minutes, as many hours out of the worker as possible. So the notion that time and money are really the same thing, that does fit in with developments during this period. Here we go. Yeah. Oh, sorry. And it also leads us back to Max Weber's notion of the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. What's distinctive about Weber's thesis, this Protestant ethic? How does that relate to capitalism? We suggested last time the key notion in Weber's thesis is the notion of rationalization, the systematic, the methodical application of rational analysis to all of one's economic decisions, all of one's economic life. Rational, systematic, methodical, and Weber's thesis was that that particular approach came out of a religious matrix, that the Calvinist emphasis, the emphasis of the Puritans on rigorous, systematic self-inspection, making every moment count, because God is watching you at all times, every minute, that notion that every minute one is under scrutiny, that of God himself or one's own scrutiny, that became the matrix for this particular approach to the calling, to your profession, your particular role in the economy. Again, the notion is that every minute counts. Every minute is crucial. You're constantly under scrutiny. Dave?
I didn't see why the Calvinist part came in, because you're already selected. It's predestined. Why does God care?
Well, that's the question is, why does God care if under a Calvinist dispensation, your salvation has already been predetermined? And a follow-up, yes. Right, exactly.
You would still be chosen either way.
You would still be chosen in any case, yes.
And how I thought it was so that one could determine for oneself whether one had been chosen, and one could tell from whether one could follow these routines that one had been.
Right. Well, more or less. In other words, the Weber thesis has a twist, and that is, even though your salvation is already predetermined, has been predetermined from the beginning, your godly behavior, your sober, rigorous, methodical behavior is a sign of your election. It's not the cause of it, it's a sign of it. And therefore it reassures you as a believer, as one of the faithful, it reassures your neighbors that you're one of the saved, one of the elect. So that's the tricky aspect of Weber's thesis. Rational behavior, disciplined behavior, sober bourgeois habits don't cause your salvation, but they do serve as a manifestation of it. They are a sign of it. Logically, it's slippery. But psychologically, it's quite understandable. All right. Well, as we suggested last time, Franklin secularized. It seems that he secularized that particular item in his cultural inheritance. His father was indeed a Calvinist, a Puritan. That's why he made the migration across the ocean. And his favorite saying was, let me see if I can find it very quickly. Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings, from Proverbs in the Bible. Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. And of course, Franklin did stand before kings and dine with them, in fact, sat with them. All right, so time is money. Let's look at one more passage from Weber's selection. Remember the saying, the good paymaster is lord of another man's purse. He that is known to pay punctually and exactly to the time he promises may at any time and on any occasion raise all the money his friends can spare. This is sometimes of great use. After industry and frugality, nothing contributes more to the raising of a young man in the world than punctuality and justice in all his dealings. Therefore, never keep borrowed money an hour beyond the time you promised, lest a disappointment shut up your friend's purse forever. Good advice in the 18th century, still good today in the 21st. The most trifling actions that affect a man's credit are to be regarded. The sound of your hammer at 5 in the morning or 8 at night, heard by a creditor, makes him easy 6 months longer. But if he sees you at a billiard table or hears your voice at a tavern when you should be at work, he sends for his money the next day, demands it before he can receive it in a lump. It shows, besides, that you are mindful of what you owe. It makes you appear as careful as well as an honest man, and that it makes you appear, sorry, a careful as well as an honest man, and that still increases your credit. Beware of thinking all your own that you possess and of living accordingly. It is a mistake that many people who have credit fall into. To prevent this, keep an exact account for some time both of your expenses and your income. If you take the pains at first to mention particulars, it will have this good effect. You will discover how wonderfully small, trifling expenses mount up to large sums and will discern what might have been and may for the future be saved without occasioning any great inconvenience. Sounds like the pitch that the mutual fund companies make about contributing early to your retirement plan and the wonderful benefits of compound interest over time. Triflingly small sums can turn into, over time, very large sums of money if you're prudent and careful and keep an accurate account of both your expenses and your income. So there again is the Calvinist or Puritan inheritance. Even trifling, nothing is so trifling as to be insignificant in the sphere of money as in the sphere of faith. The most trifling actions that affect a man's credit are to be regarded. The sound of your hammer at 5 in the morning, heard by a creditor, makes him easy. If he sees you at a billiard table or hears your voice at a tavern, then you're in trouble. These are the passages that Max Weber took as the best, the most paradigmatic examples of what he calls the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. He argues that Franklin got this inheritance from his Boston upbringing, from his Calvinist Puritan forefathers, that New England, among all of the American colonies, New England is the locus classicus, the birthplace of the spirit of this kind of rational ethos or rationalizing ethos, which is so important, so integral to modern capitalism. Okay, so that's the theory. And it seems to me that Weber has an insight not only into capitalism generally, but into Franklin more particularly. But he also goes too far. He says, Franklin believed that man is dominated by the making of money, by acquisition as the ultimate purpose of his life. And this acquisitive ethic was expressed in all his works without exception. I think that's a mistake. I think we already know enough about Franklin to know that it's a mistake. It's too large a generalization. So perhaps we can begin by talking a little bit about what's insightful and where the thesis falls short when we apply it to Franklin in particular. So, first of all, it seems to me that at some level, psychologically, Weber is absolutely right about Franklin, even if he's wrong about Franklin's ideology, ultimately. He's right about the psychology. There must have been something in Franklin's makeup that responded to this particular ethos, this particular style of living. Because throughout his life, and we notice it in the autobiography, he was a list maker, a man who kept careful accounts, a man who did have a rational approach, not only to his economic fortunes, but to self-improvement more generally. He derives psychological gratification from that kind of behavior, that approach to life, that sense of mastery, that sense of confidence that one gets by adopting a cost-benefit or a moral accounting approach to the design of one's life and career. It really does appeal to him psychologically. Okay. So no doubt Weber's right about that. But there are a number of ways in which the thesis doesn't work if we look at Franklin's life as a whole. So, number one, the thesis is that the Protestant ethic is anything but hedonistic. In other words, the bourgeois character, which for Weber means the modern character, the capitalist character, the essence of it is the denial or the postponement of easy gratification in the service of a careful husbanding of resources over time. So it's anti-pleasure, but we know very well that Franklin was a hedonist, that he loved pleasure of various kinds, and especially later in his life, this was someone who delighted not only in every kind of sociability, every kind of conversation and club and social activity, but who loved women, especially if they were French. And if they were much younger than he, absolutely. He approved of all of the Ten Commandments except the one about not coveting your neighbor's wife. So if it's true that he derives psychological reinforcement from that ethos of accumulation, of self-denial in the service of the accumulation of wealth, later on, it's certainly true that he shifted gears, that his life became very different He retired at 42 and he devoted himself to public service, to science, but also to the enjoyment of life. He believed in pleasure. there's a kind of genial quality, jovial quality, which we notice in so many of his writings, and which makes him different from the other founding fathers. A sense of humor, a love of jokes and hoaxes, conviviality. This is the founding father we would like to go and share a drink with at a tavern. Those of us who still go to taverns, as opposed to the more stone-like George Washington or the others. So we miss something essential about Franklin's character if we see this as the core of it. Well, second point. Franklin broke with Calvinism. Franklin broke with Puritanism. He broke very early with the religion of his parents. That is to say, first of all, he rejected the notion, the Calvinist notion, of the sinful unworthiness of humanity, the corollary of justification by faith alone. He rejected both of those things in terms of an image of humanity, well, various, but with a capacity for benevolence, for sociability. His notion, which we notice early on in Edmund Morgan's selection of his journals, his notion that we are by nature social creatures works against the Augustinian or the Calvinist notion that we are basically sinful and corrupt. He has no illusions about human nature, and he sees that the world is full of rogues, but he doesn't think in terms of sin. In his own life, he thinks in terms of errata, as we saw last time. A sin is something that gets at the core of your being. An erratum, an error, is something that is corrigible, that can be corrected. Of course, he takes the term erratum from the vocabulary of printers, but he applies it to his own life in his autobiography. The notion that mistakes are not irremediable or beyond redemption, that you can get a second chance. Well, in any case, all of this takes him very far from Calvinism. And the most basic point about his religious faith, of course, is that he believes in the efficacy of good works. He believes that goodness is the goodness, benevolence, service to one's neighbor is the best way of expressing our devotion or gratitude to God. And that's a notion which is as un-Calvinist as it could possibly be, but it is the core of Benjamin Franklin's religious conviction. Here are a few quotations. The only religious doctrine he could be sure of was that, quote, if God loved all his creatures, then the best way to serve God was to serve your fellow men. The slogan that he picked for his library, to pour forth benefits for the common good, is divine. To pour forth benefits for the common good is divine. The best way to express our gratitude to God is to serve others. And again, nothing could be further from his Calvinist inheritance. Puritanism, like any sectarian faith, was not known for tolerance, but Franklin was. It's another important aspect of his religiosity. He doesn't go to church, but he contributes money to all of the churches in Philadelphia, and not just the churches. But on his deathbed, it appears he was the largest single contributor to the synagogue in Philadelphia. When Franklin died, every clergyman in the city, including the rabbi, marched in his funeral procession. There is a quotation from him in which he says, if the Mufti of Constantinople were available to come to Philadelphia to preach a sermon, why not listen to him? We might learn something. In other words, his tolerance extended beyond Christian sects to embrace Judaism and Islam as well. So he is very, very far from his Protestant origins. Well, a third deficiency of the Weber thesis as applied to Franklin, his attitude to money was instrumental. In other words, he saw it very definitely as a means to an end. He didn't think in terms of accumulating money for its own sake. There is a letter that he wrote to his mother, I believe, in which he says, thinking about his epitaph, he would rather the gravestone say something about something to the effect, he lived well, not he was rich. He lived well. He did something with his money. He did good with his money. Now, that is not what Weber had in mind. What Weber had in mind was a commitment to wealth making, which had no larger purpose whatsoever. In other words, a commitment to accumulation for its own sake. Rational pursuit of wealth in the service of an irrational commitment to accumulation for its own sake. Well, that is not Franklin at all. What is essential to Franklin's life and career is the bending of hard-earned wealth towards public purposes. In fact, there's an element of radicalism in Franklin's attitude towards wealth. The most read author in Franklin's library was John Locke. And of course, John Locke is one of the great English theorists of liberty, but also of property. And in fact, he comes close to identifying the two. But Franklin was an artisan. Unlike the other founding fathers, as we saw last time, he worked with his hands, and he had an artisan's theory of wealth. That is to say, he was a believer not in the absolute sanctity of private property, but rather in what the Marxists would later call the labor theory of value. Where does it come from, wealth? Ultimately, it comes from labor. It comes from hard work. But that in turn produces a corollary. What we have above what we can use is not properly ours, though we possess it. In other words, the government, if we draw the conclusion, the government has a right to tax your surplus wealth. And Franklin was an early advocate of progressive taxation. Those who earn more should pay more for the common good. And that takes us to our final point about the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, which is that Franklin was essentially not a capitalist he was a philanthropist. Philanthropy is more basic to his life and career than money-making. And that really is the main subject, I think, of our second half hour today. Franklin as citizen, Franklin as philanthropist. And we've talked about this before in our introduction last week. Franklin did more founding than any of the other founders, one institution after another. What was he after? I mean, what? How did that work? What was the theory behind all of that institution building? What was the point of it? Well, okay. Age 21. As a young man in Philadelphia, a printer, an artisan, he joins the Leather Apron Club. Artisan self-help clubs are a common feature of early modern history, and indeed right through the 19th and 20th centuries, we find this pattern. People who work with their hands, but who have a certain degree of education, form clubs, societies for self-improvement, discussion clubs. And this is one of those examples. Franklin, at 21, is one of the founders, one of the early members of the Leather Apron Club, which became the Junto. Eventually, it would become the American Philosophical Society, which, of course, still exists today. A society for learned conversation designed not only to improve members of the society, but to have a payoff in terms of civic enhancement. Self-improvement and civic enhancement go together in this way of thinking. All right, so early on, we have ambitious members of the artisan class in Philadelphia trying to improve themselves, to improve their manners, to improve their learning. And from that beginning, a spillover into civic improvement projects. Now, of course, the first one is the library. So how does that work? If you're an artisan, you're ambitious, you want to become more learned, obviously one way to do that is by reading. There's a huge shortage of books in 18th century America. Books are expensive to produce, and therefore they're not produced. Printers don't produce them unless there's a good market for them, and that would mean, of course, religious literature, but that's not what these ambitious artisans were after. Well, that would then mean getting books from England, but books from England are expensive. And so the first thing that Franklin and his fellow members of the Leather Apron Club decided to do was to pool their books and make a library from bringing their meager collections of books together. It didn't work. Worked for a while, for a year, but Franklin had a better idea, and that was not so much to gather together the few books that they had, but rather to pool their funds and to buy books that would then become the basis of a circulating library. So that's the beginning of the Philadelphia Library, and of course, the model spread to the other colonies, and it's Franklin's first great success in institution building. All right, so perfect example of the confluence between self-improvement and civic enhancement, which is central to this version of philanthropy. All right, well, what comes next?
Fire departments.
Fire departments, absolutely. Fire departments, great example. Franklin, very concerned about the threat of fire in these burgeoning towns like Philadelphia, all constructed of wood. Devastating fires could wipe out huge amounts of property. Why not have a volunteer fire department? But maybe not entirely volunteer, because Franklin's idea was, how about giving members of the fire departments a tax break, tax abatement? Enlightened self-interest was the key to Franklin's notion of civic improvement. Give people an incentive, make it rational for them to do this, so that you emphasize the link between their benefit and the larger social purpose. In fact, many of the discussions of the Leather Apron Club revolved around exactly that nexus, how to identify those particular ways in which self-improvement and civic improvement go together. Well, let's take another one, police. Obviously, fire is one of the important social services. Police are another. In early Philadelphia, there's no professional police force. There are constables, a handful of them. They, in turn, are responsible for getting people to patrol the streets, getting citizens to patrol the streets. But many citizens don't want that duty imposed on them. They have the opportunity to buy themselves out of it. They pay a fee, and the constables go after someone else to patrol the streets. Well, who's available to patrol the streets if the good bourgeois people of the town are not willing to do it? They go into the taverns to get people to patrol the streets. In other words, their policemen, their amateur policemen, are drunk half the time. Not good. And of course, Franklin wrote a paper about this. Why not have a professional police force? Why not, in fact, since this is a public purpose, why not tax ourselves in order to pay for sober policemen to watch our streets at night? That was the basic idea. Well, how does he put this over? Franklin, whenever he had a good idea, would let it circulate in the Leather Apron Club. He would then write an article about it in his own newspaper. He would sign the article with a pseudonym. So it appeared that there's a movement, a campaign behind this particular idea, and not that it is just another project of Benjamin Franklin. Edmund Morgan has a way of describing this method. He says Franklin was the captain of the campaign, but he presented himself as a mere foot soldier. He never tried to take credit for these ideas. He believed more effective if he stayed in the background. And it worked over and over again. It worked. Universities. University of Pennsylvania. What made it different? Open to all aspiring and diligent young men. Not, unfortunately, yet women, but all aspiring, diligent, and young men. Different from Princeton, Harvard, Yale, from the other early colleges, which were more elitist in their orientation, and which were religious in their orientation, were Calvinist, essentially, designed to produce ministers. Not so Franklin's University of Pennsylvania, which was a secular institution from the beginning. Harvard and Princeton and Yale were designed to produce clergymen. So one great institution after another. How do we explain the context? When Franklin arrived in Philadelphia, 1722 or 3, the city was raw. It was growing rapidly. And as with so many burgeoning towns, its infrastructure was inadequate for its population. That's not unusual. But Philadelphia was distinctive in another respect, and that is the colony was not, like so many of the others, a royal colony governed directly by the crown, working through parliament. It was a proprietary colony. In effect, the Penn family owned Pennsylvania. But the Penn family were absentee landlords. They didn't live in Franklin's time in Philadelphia. They were back in London. They were absentee landlords. And what this meant, of course, is that government in Philadelphia was even more inefficient than it was elsewhere, because everything depended on the approval of the Penn family back in England, which meant, what, 2 or 3 months away by mail back and forth. It meant that public services were basically absent. There wasn't a committee, a local committee, a town meeting in the New England sense that could produce a response to local needs. The discussion didn't really matter unless it could get some sort of approval from faraway England. And Franklin was very conscious of that gap, and he strove to fill it by engaging in private philanthropy as a substitute for public action, as a substitute for a government that really wasn't functioning. So, in any case, it puts him once again at the center of developments in 18th century America. The founding of all of those institutions outside of the sphere of government, the founding of institutions by civically minded private individuals working together. It became, of course, one of the great features of American society, of American culture. It's what the 18th century would learn to call civil society. Civil society meaning those activities of groups of citizens which are outside the immediate sphere of government but which fulfill a public purpose. The health of civil society is one of the most crucial features of a healthy modern society. We are, in other words, in a realm which is somewhere between the unrestricted operation of the market, the spirit of capitalism, and on the other hand, the realm of government, which can be heavy-handed and in this case somewhat aloof and distant. We're in a middle zone where civic virtue and civic activism produces incremental improvements, not the perfect society, but measurable good, answering particular needs. And Franklin was an expert at spotting those deficiencies, those needs, which could be filled by an aroused citizenry, by organization. And here we have, again, the spillover from his Protestant ethic background. It's the idea that every action, no matter how trivial, if it's designed for a public purpose, if there's a systematic effort behind it, can produce genuine results. A particular citizen can start a campaign that can transform his city. That's an idea which it seems to me has enormous appeal. And it makes Franklin it's one of the things that makes him such an attractive figure. All right, let's rehearse. Let's back that up. If Franklin were no more than the embodiment of the virtues of Polonius, you know, in Shakespeare's Hamlet, neither a borrower nor a lender be, all of that bourgeois advice that Polonius gives to his son Laertes. Well, Shakespeare's Polonius is a windbag. Those are bourgeois virtues, but Shakespeare presents him as a hypocrite and a windbag. If Franklin were nothing, if there's nothing else other than the recipe for wealth that we find in the passages that Max Weber quoted, then Franklin would not be nearly as interesting as he really is. What makes him so fascinating is that he is the best of the bourgeois spirit. And that bourgeois spirit is not narrowly devoted to the accumulation of wealth for its own sake. That middle class spirit, that bourgeois spirit, is devoted, yes, to the pursuit of wealth, but always with a view towards not just individual accumulation and self-advancement, but civic purposes as well. And you look at the great tradition of American philanthropy, even the most hideous of our millionaires in the Gilded Age produced great philanthropic institutions. They may have been bastards in many ways. The rich men of the late 19th century, but they followed in Franklin's footsteps when they created great museums and libraries, Carnegie and so on. Great universities, absolutely. It's one of the things that makes American capitalism work as well as it does. It's not just money for its own sake. The philanthropy is an essential part of the picture. Okay, let's pause here before we take our break and see if there are comments, questions about anything we've talked about this evening.
I'd like to know how a militia fit into this. Could he build one, considering that, or did he have to get in touch with the pens in England?
The question is, how does a militia fit into this picture? Did he need the approval of the pens? Why a militia in the first place? Again, I think there was a fundamental failure, negligence on the part of the pens. Franklin felt very keenly the threat of the frontier, which meant the alliance between the French and the Indians. A sense that Philadelphia itself could be in danger. And therefore, a militia was an obvious need, some sort of defense force. But the government wouldn't pay for it. And so Franklin decided to raise the money himself. Did he need permission to do it? There was a problem there. I'm not sure how that was resolved. But he did it. He did it. One other key, by the way, before we move on, the first hospital in Philadelphia for the poor, how did he do it? The idea of matching grant, that the assembly would match the contributions of private citizens. The first matching grant is Franklin's. Robert. Yes, an insurance company. The first insurance company, an outgrowth, I believe, of the fire business, very much related to the threat of fire. Around 1750 or so, the first insurance company in Pennsylvania. And not to be sure the first in the English-speaking world, but a very early example of that. Yes?
How many of these are Franklin's inventions? I mean, he seems too prolific. Secular universities, volunteer fire departments, I think there were even municipal bonds seem to be invented by him. How much of this, were ideas pre-existing, but the Collins was pregnant for the for their institutionalization?
Well, I don't think that any of these institutions was totally original. I think that in England, there were examples of most of them, but Franklin was operating in a cultural vacuum. Philadelphia was undergoverned. The only institutions, basically, aside from a rather ineffectual assembly, and that was part of the larger Pennsylvania, were churches and schools. And beyond that, there's really very little. So I don't think these institutions were totally, totally new. But on the other hand, they were the first for Philadelphia and sometimes for the colonies as a whole. But as we'll see after the break when we turn to the question of Franklin as printer, there's an interesting distinction between his activities as a philanthropist and his record as a businessman printer. With institutions, he was usually the first. With his printing business, he was usually the second. That is to say, someone else was already publishing a newspaper, a magazine, government printing business, paper money, whatever. Someone else had gotten there first, and Franklin was the second. But Franklin tried harder and made himself into the most important printer in the country. Yes?
It appears that he was, in terms of understanding human nature, all of these ideas and how prolific he was, yet the way he kind of put himself out of the target. You know, you comment about Morgan, you know, he was a captain but appeared in a foot soldier. So I guess he understood that too much in the public eye, he would be attacked after a while by all these good ideas.
Right.
So instead, have somebody else do it and
right.
succeed in the and the willingness, I think, to put himself in that position, maybe lack of ego in some aspects, but also I think it was more understanding that if he didn't do it, he would probably be attacked just because of the prolific nature of what all the things that he did.
Right. He learned early on to avoid offending people by dominating a debate or a conversation. So he was able to suppress his ego. I'm sure he had a very healthy ego, but he was able to suppress it, and he didn't need to take credit That was not a psychological need for him. A very pragmatic attitude. What works? What gets things done? What enlists people's active participation and cooperation in a campaign? And undoubtedly, he took a certain pleasure, in fact, in disguising his own participation. And this is one of the things that's very difficult to understand about him. But again, if you think about it, why does Max Weber make a mistake in saying that this is the essence of Ben Franklin when he points to time is money and all of these passages about frugality and industry? It seems to me the mistake is he took one of Franklin's identities, one of his personae, and treated it as the essence. But Franklin had multiple personae. I wouldn't say he had multiple personalities. That would be a different thing. But he had multiple identities. And here's a man, after all, who had dozens and dozens of pseudonyms, who signed his newspaper articles with dozens of phony names rather than his own. There must be something that appealed to him about masquerade, disguising himself, holding himself in reserve. There's a famous line in the autobiography, I believe, you know, something like this. Let other people know you, but let no man know you totally. Always keep something of yourself in reserve. Yes.
I think that's very true in the autobiography. I think he deliberately conceals the fact that he figured out early in life that he wanted to be rich and he wanted to live an independent, luxurious, and free life. And the only way to gain freedom was to gain wealth. He doesn't say that anywhere, but that was clearly his motive.
Right.
But his motives were more complex than that.
Yes.
He intended to use that freedom for these public purposes.
Right, right.
He never shirked a demand on his time.
Yes.
Once he was free of having to work with his hands. But he never says that.
He'll never say it. He doesn't reveal himself completely in the autobiography. In fact, many scholars have suggested recently that the autobiography is one more persona. There's one more mask that he's invented for his audience. Yeah. Yes.
So on whose philosophically, on whose shoulders does he stand? Calvinism is clear. That's
right. No, he's not an original thinker, philosophically. Excuse me. He's a great publicist. He's a great, Walter Isaacson, in his wonderful biography, which many of you, I'm sure, have already looked at, Walter Isaacson suggests that, among other firsts, he's our first expert on public relations, on the management of impressions. Where does he come from philosophically? You know, he read John Locke. I'm sure he read most of the great figures of the Scottish Enlightenment. But my guess is that his basic philosophical position was formed very early by his earliest reading. And that would have been people like Daniel Defoe, who's not a philosopher really, but the first great novelist. Cotton Mather, who was a Puritan theologian, but someone from whom Franklin learned. What he did, in other words, was to follow in the footsteps of the great proto-Enlightenment figures in English history whose essential role was to secularize the Puritan inheritance. And again, if you think of your memories of Robinson Crusoe, Crusoe is very important for, sorry, not Crusoe, but Defoe was very important for Benjamin Franklin. He was a great journalist before he was a novelist. He had multiple pseudonyms. Even now, they can't track all of his newspaper articles because he wrote them under fake names. But Defoe wrote something called an essay on projects. Essay on projects. In the 17th century, the word project had a much broader meaning than it does for us now. Essay on projects, that means civic improvements. It means civic activism. It's the Puritan ethic transposed into a secular and public context. The notion that you can make a difference if you plan, if you work systematically, that you can promote the public good by the systematic marshalling of your own and your neighbors' civic energies. So philosophically, I wouldn't say that he's a Lockean. I think he comes out of John Bunyan and Daniel Defoe and the Puritan line insofar as it became secularized.
Would John Stuart Mill's writings have been available to him? Is that later?
Later. Yeah, John Stuart Mill is a 19th century figure.
There's
no connection there. Anything else?
When he was in London as a very young man, were there examples of the civic improvements and that kind of thing there that he could have taken back to Philly?
Yes. What's the importance of his travel, his sojourn in London, in terms of these ideas for civic improvement? Of course, London was approximately 100 times bigger than Philadelphia, maybe more. London was in the 18th century was already approaching a million. Philadelphia was 6,000. So, totally different scale. But nevertheless,
have Rockefellers or Bill Gates doing things at that time?
They were beginning in London. Well, again, people like Defoe. The beginning of this effort to take the fruits of capitalism and use them to modify, to ameliorate the condition of the poor. So let's take an example from around 1750. I wish I had a picture with me, but the great artist of that period is Hogarth, William Hogarth. And we know Hogarth for all of his great paintings of people coming from the country and being corrupted by the big city. But when he did portraits, there's a great portrait of a huge man, the big, prosperous belly, whose name is Captain Coram, made his money going back and forth between America and London, and rum. I don't know what it was, rum or who knows. His contribution was a foundling hospital. Franklin, as we know from the selections in Morgan, one of the selections in Morgan, very concerned about the number of abandoned children in the big cities of Paris and London. So here in 1750, there is this prosperous sea captain who's painted by the great artist Hogarth. What did he do with all of his money? He built a foundling hospital. He built an institution. The city government wasn't doing anything about it. He did it himself. And Franklin admired that kind of person. So there were English examples. And let's return, before we take our break, one more time to our major theme. Benjamin Franklin and the world of the Enlightenment. This notion of civic improvement fits perfectly with the ethos of the Enlightenment. The pursuit of happiness. If the Enlightenment stood against something, it was against the notion of original sin. The notion that we are basically doomed or damned by the corruption of our souls, which is innate in us, it's inveterate in us. The basic Enlightenment notion, we are not doomed. That's a superstition that only makes things worse. It's an excuse for not doing anything. The Enlightenment notion is that we can, because we're not damned or doomed, we can make a difference. We can make ourselves happier. We can make our society better. We can promote happiness. And Franklin, from the beginning, is at the core. That's the core of his worldview. So in other words, what we have is somebody who made the jump from the Calvinist, Puritan, religious world, which nevertheless leaves an impression on him. Work hard. Plan carefully. Every trivial thing counts. That's all the Protestant inheritance. But he makes the jump from that into the secular, modernizing world of the Enlightenment, which is the world not of original sin, but the world of civic improvement. He's the bridge figure in American culture between those two worlds. Between the world of the 17th century and the world of the 18th. And again, let's remember, he was older than all the other founding fathers by at least a quarter of a century. So he really does make that bridge. Born in 1706, his parents were Puritans when there were Puritans. I mean, it's not just a distant inheritance. They really were Puritans. He comes from that background. And he makes the bridge into the brave new world of the secular Enlightenment.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.